Good morning to everybody. We'll start a class today in just about 1 minute. We'll continue with our discussion about Joseph in Egypt. And today we'll be working from this past Parsha Miketz. In chapter 41, verse 50, and we just start momentarily. And we'll just do a brief audio check. Once you hear the audio feed, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen. It'll confirm that you're picking up the audio stream properly. And again, we'll start in just about 1 minute. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good, Doug. How you doing? How you doing, Cal?
Doing okay. Cal is here, but should be here in just a couple of minutes.
Okay.
And Rivka is online, and someone else just joined, too, I think.
Okay.
Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning, Pamela. Good morning, Rivka.
Good morning, and someone else just joined, too.
And Josh, good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Hey, Naomi. Hey, Naomi. How are you? Okay.
I can't hear very well. I don't know if it's the reception or not, but I can't hear very well. I hear a lot of background noise. You guys?
Yeah, Rivka, I think you're going to get a delay if you have both the online speaker session running and the phone.
Right, and I can hear both.
Offline?
Yeah, just turn off the speakers.
I can hear the echo every time she speaks.
Yeah, if you're on the web, also just turn off the speakers. All right, so whoever has their speakers on the web and you're also on the phone, turn off your computer speakers.
I turn off the speaker. That should help.
Right.
Okay, great.
There you go. Much better.
That's good, right?
Okay. All right, so let's take up another part of, we're talking on Thursday about Joseph in Egypt and about the dreams. And I think we uncovered some very beautiful ideas by seeing how he was primed for dream interpretation long before his dissension, because he had the dreams when he was younger. That caused the animosity and the jealousy of his brothers, and he experienced the dreams with the baker and the wine steward, and then he had the dreams of Paro told to him, and you see in the blink of an eye he was able to interpret them on the spot. And it does not seem, at least from the verses, that there's any gap in time between Paro telling him the dreams and then Joseph interpreting them, which would indicate that there was no divine information given to him. He just figured it out on his own, because he had an amazing ability to understand dreams and to determine what is a prophetic dream and what's not. And as we said, the verses bear out that that's what Joseph said to Paro, that your dreams are really one. And that's why Paro liked his interpretation as opposed to the astrologers, because Joseph was showing Paro there's something unique in the structure of your dream, not so much the content, but the structure itself that it duplicated It's not natural. And that's exactly what Joseph saw with the wine steward and the baker. They had duplicate dreams. And Joseph had duplicate dreams himself about the sheaves of wheat bowing down to his sheaf, and the stars and the sun and moon bowing down to him. So you see duplication, and that's something which is indicative of a prophetic dream. And Ibn Ezra says that clearly. Now, after he has been placed as a viceroy, being the head of Egypt, so what happens is we're now in Genesis 41, verse. Let's start with verses about 47, and we'll run through to about 53. So just a few verses. So it says, this is now, you know, Joseph is in power already. It says in 46 that Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from before Pharaoh, and he passed through the entire land of Egypt. So he surveyed the situation. And they had the plenty in verse 47, and they put everything in storehouses. 48 says that they gathered together all the food during the 7 years that were in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, of plenty. And then it says that he put the food, it says according to Rashi that they put some, that Joseph had an insight that if you put some of the soil of the vegetation, of the plant, the crop, if you mix that in with the grain, that'll preserve it. And it worked well. That's what the 48 tells you. 49 says that Joseph gathered grain like the sands of the sea. Exceedingly great quantity. Until a point where they just ceased off from counting. Then it says that Joseph had two sons before the years of the famine came that were born to him from Asnath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On. And in 51 it says that Joseph called the names of his, he called the name of his older son, the firstborn, Menasseh, because the word means that God had caused me to forget all of my my toil in the house of my father. And the name of the second son he called Ephraim, because God had increased his success in the land of his affliction. All right, so it tells you that he had two sons, and what the names were and what the meanings were. Then it says in 53 that there ended the 7 years of plenty that were in Egypt. And in 54, there began the 7 years of the famine. All right, so let's stop there. And you tell me what seems to be a question in what we just read.
Well, Rabbi, you mentioned an interpretation that caught my attention back up on 48, the second half. He gathered all food of the 7 years that came to pass in Egypt, and he placed food in the cities. Okay. The food of the field around each city he placed within it. Now, I've always read that to mean that he took the local food that they grew and put that in the storehouse that was in that city. But you had an interpretation that he took something of the earth and stuck it in there?
Yeah, that's based on Rashi. That was, what, 48?
Yes.
Right, so that's a plain interpretation. And just let me see if the English says anything different. That was what, 41? Let's see what it says here. Yeah. Yeah, so the English translates, he gathered all food of the 7 years that came to pass in the land of Egypt, and he placed food in the cities, the food of the field around each city he placed within it. So when it says the food of the field, around each city he placed within it seems to be that he's placing the food locally, right?
Right.
Rashi says an interesting thing. It says that he says because all the lands sustain their fruits, and they placed in the grain from the earth of that place, and it preserved the grain from rotting. That's Rashi on 48. So it's telling you another point in terms of how he preserved, because this is going to have to last 7 years. So he had a solution to that as well.
And I guess, with great respect to Rashi, I've never heard anything in gardening or food preservation that indicates if you put soil in with the food from where it came from, that that helps preserve it in any way.
Right.
And then how would you separate it out afterward?
Well, they would just sift it. That's not a problem.
They have such a dry climate over there, I would assume that they were able to keep the grain dry. Grain is one of those things you can store for a very long time.
Oh, well, maybe that had a drying effect. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But read on further, and tell me what seems to be bothersome about these this series of verses. What seems to be out of place?
What's with the kids?
Yeah, what do you mean?
Well, we're rolling along here talking about the food, and we gathered all the food, and we put it in the cities, and we had these 7 years of abundance, and then they came to an end, and then there's 7 years of famine. Okay, that all flows. Right in the middle, in verse 50 to 52, we suddenly have this interspersion of Joseph having kids before the famine had set in.
Right.
Which doesn't flow nicely.
Exactly. That's the problem. The problem is exactly as you stated it. It's, everything's flowing nice. It's all germane to the subject. And 49 continues and says that he stored up, and there was a tremendous amount, and there was the years of, because of the plenty, and they even ceased from counting the amount of grains they had because they were so abundant. From there, it should have gone on to, from 49, it should have gone straight to 53, where it says, then those 7 years came to an end. Right? But it doesn't. It throws in this thing about Joseph and his two sons, and what the names were. And it tells you that the name of the first one was because he called him Menashe, because that means that God caused him to forget the toil of his house. And the second one he called Ephraim, because that talks about becoming successful. Right. Okay, you got the question.
Yep.
Take it away. What is the reason why? You got to look at this a little bit. Look at what he's, the name of his children, of course, is very significant. And then we'll have to understand, what are these two names? What are they, and the Torah is telling you the idea behind the names of the children. This is not an easy question, but that is the question. This is glaring. All right, everybody's got the question?
Rabbi, I'm not sure, but I'm just wondering, does it exhibit the fact that Yosef was confident, he had his children, and the fact that he had his children, the fact that there was also the famine, it somehow didn't disturb him as much. He was able to have children and have faith that things would work out. I'm not sure if I'm right, but I'm just getting that feeling.
Okay. And what about the names? What about the names of the children? What does that come to tell us?
The names of the children exhibit the fact that he was able to forget all the pain that he had from previous.
It
had happened to him.
Right.
And that he can look forward, I think, from the names I was getting this.
Well, that's what he says. The first name, Menashe, is that once he had him, he now was able to forget about the pains of his family. But now we have to explain what that is doing right here, because right now they're still in the years of the plenty.
And he's focused on what is going on currently. I think it's a lesson for us But again, I'm not sure that I'm clear on this. Just a feeling I have.
Okay, let's look at it more. Look at more of the verses and look into what the names were. And trying to see how this relates, because again, he is still in the years of plenty at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It actually says that. It says in verse 50 that Joseph had two sons before the years of the famine. So that's also significant. It's telling us that he had the sons before the famine.
Okay, right, that's true. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Could it imply the good fortune that Joseph was reflecting back on, that everything turned out for the good, so it must be under God's plan?
Mm-hmm. Why would you say that?
He's seeing the big picture.
The big picture. Well, why is it interrupting the discussion of the years of famine, and, you know, plenty and famine, and telling us about the naming of his sons?
Well, it seems like just the fact that the sons were born before the famine happened. Having children is a sense of abundance and goodness and good fortune. And so all of this abundance has happened in the good time. And he's reflecting back that, you know, here he was enslaved and all of the horrible things that happened, but he's able to forget that because so much goodness has come about as a result.
Okay, I hear you. All right, anybody else want to suggest anything?
I have another question.
Yes.
When in verse 51, it says, Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh for, quote, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's household, unquote. Well, first of all, that's not really true. He didn't forget all those people and all that stuff. And why would it say, in addition, my hardship and all my father's household? Why does he want to forget his father's household?
Well, it seemed to be, of course, he's not forgetting, he's not losing his memory. But what is he forgetting about his father's household?
Pain.
Right, the pain.
The pain of what happened to him.
Right, the pain of what happened
to him. Also the fact that he's not there anymore. He misses his father.
Right, so this is now causing a certain displacement of his attention. But again, without explaining why it's... I mean, Cal was touching on it, it's showing... it's paralleling the success of Egypt and also his own personal success of children.
Right.
Right. So that's one thing for sure.
And also, Robbie, is it possible that he's obtaining strength from this blessing, and he has no reward that there's going to be the famine, but he has a certain strength that it will work out okay?
Well, it doesn't say that.
Is it possible that's what he was thinking?
Well, what we have to do is stay true to the verses. I mean, they're written very precisely for a reason. So, you know, we can always suggest other things that might be true, but what I like to do is to use these opportunities where we're learning together to look at the verses and let ourselves be trained by the actual wording. So we have to stay 100% loyal to the verses. And let the verses themselves bring out the idea. Not to, you know, the other things may be true, but I'd like to do is understand this apparent interruption and really try to define what these verses are telling us just from the words of the verse. So the verse says that it was before the famine came. That's number one. It says, you know, in terms of the interruptive verses, right? That's 50, 51, 52. That's what we have to focus on.
Okay.
So it says that before the famine came is the first thing. He had two sons. Some reason it's very clear again who his wife is. I mean, why do you have to be so detailed? It was Asnas, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of the city of On. It's funny. But he says he called the name of his eldest Menashe because God had caused him to forget all the toil, the pain of his father's household. So that tells you he was carrying around that inside of him up to this point. Right, so that you deduce clearly. But now something changed that allowed him to have some sort of a shift of focus. Not that he had loss of memory, of course. And then the second name, that he became successful. But still, the success was the last words in that verse 52. In the land of my affliction. Interesting. Why is it telling you that? Why isn't it just saying I became successful? No, it's still, it carried, he still referred to Egypt as the land of his affliction. So look at the verses and the words, and try to let the words speak to you, like Rabbi Chait would always say, you know, let the words talk to you, without adding anything, but, you know, using the words themselves as the springboard for the answer. And Yeshayahu, you're asking if the name Ephraim has anything to do with the abundant harvest. Yes. Yeah, he was very successful. That was the success. It was also the success of him being the viceroy.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I am drawn to the verse that says, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's household, given the name of Manasseh. He hasn't forgotten his father, but he's forgotten the hardship and his father's household, which means maybe the brothers.
Yes.
But it doesn't seem like he's forgotten his father, like that's a key relationship.
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that one is being offset more than the other. It says that God had caused to forget the toil, the pain of his father's household. That means everybody, I think. I mean, of course, his father didn't cause him any pain. I mean, so surely it's referring to the brothers.
Right. But I wonder if that implies then that he still hasn't forgotten the teachings of his father in order to pass them along to his son.
True. But then it's going further than the verse really warrants. You see, I would say as follows, that when you see, and this is a style of the Torah that happens many times, that you'll have a series of verses, and then there's something which is interdispersed. When you intersperse something of which seems contrary, that's to, that contrast is to raise questions. That's the actual design of the Torah, to bring out a point. So the series of verses are talking about the years of plenty at this point, like we said, correct? And then it's interrupted with discussion of the names of his sons. And in specific, we see that this is while he is still experiencing the great wealth, the great years of plenty, and we also see that it's the phenomena of children that causes him to forget his father's household. Number two, and number three, we also see that even after he's giving praise to God by naming his second son Ephraim, that he was successful, but nonetheless, in the land of my affliction. So, I believe what the Torah is doing here is showing you another facet to the great character of Joseph. That right amidst his rise to power and the great success, so typically a person would be on a tremendous high, and he would become self-absorbed. And certainly, when you think about the contrast of him being the lowest member of that caste system and then being a slave, and then rising to being virtually the king. He's running everything. Like Paro said, only in the throne we're going to be different than everything else. And like Unculus says, that the Egyptians called him the father of Paro. He was even superior in terms of that. That his wisdom exceeded everybody there. And amidst all that, and the gathering of the grain, and piling them up in the cities, and preserving them, it tells us that he was now able, through his sons, to forget the pain of his father, his father's household. What is the contrast? Clearly the contrast is telling you that despite the great success, his focus was always on family and people, not personal success. So it throws in these verses right in the middle of his great success, the peak of his success, while he's still in the years of plenty, to show you what's the focus of Joseph. The focus of Joseph was he was concerned about his father and his brothers, and that was always on his mind. But now that he had his own family to start, now some of that energy was being withdrawn, and the pain was being mitigated, being obscured by the fact that he had his own children. But you see, it didn't shift from his parents, his father and his brothers to success. It shifted from one family focus, his old family, his father's house, to his own family. So without a beat, there was no absorption by Joseph into the success. It's showing you a great perfection. Okay, so that's number one. That's what you see about, just in general, the first step that we would make is saying that amidst the great success, his focus remained perfection of people and his children and himself, and he was still concerned about his brothers. Right, and that he carried along even during the great years, the years of plenty. It wasn't until he had children that he removed his energies. But you see, even when he had the plenty, he was still focused on his brothers and his father. And you see when the brothers came down, how readily he was to work out a plan to perfect them. That's why he had the Rebbe Chaik give a beautiful class years ago and explained it. Why did he set up the brothers and put the money back in their sacks? And then he puts the goblet into this to Benjamin, because he wanted to put the brothers in the exact same situation. Would they now forego Benjamin and abandon him? Because that's what Joseph said. No, whoever we found the goblet with, so he's going to be a slave to me, and the rest of you can go home in peace. And you see, he did the whole thing with the money in the sacks previously because he wanted to show he was fair. He didn't want to give them any reason that the brothers should now try to attack physically, because they saw he's a man of reason. So he set that up in terms of giving the money and the sacks of all of them, and then when they came back and they returned the money, they were told, no, keep it, it's an oversight, don't worry about it. So they saw that this viceroy, who at that time they didn't know was Joseph, that they saw this man was very straight. And Rabbi Avihar once said a very good point. He said that initially when the sons came down and Joseph started to accuse them of being spies, and he locked them in the house for 3 days. Before he locked them up to be under surveillance for 3 days, he says to them, I fear God. You'll stay here, 9 of you stay here, and 1 of you go back and validate your story that you have another brother. And then with that validation, I'll know you're telling me the truth, and you're not spies. After the 3 days, he says, you know what? I'll let all of you go back, but 1 of you will stay here. So Rabbi Har explained how he was showing again a leniency. And by doing that, in the brothers' eyes, they saw that this man was reasonable. So you don't need to resort to any type of military tactics when you see that the man is reasonable. So he was doing that to ensure that they wouldn't try to get Joseph or do something brutal like Simon and Levi did when they destroyed Shechem. So that was to prime them to view him in terms of being an intelligent leader. So therefore, when the goblet was found, they didn't know what to do. They just said, it's our sin. But Joseph, no. They were willing to be slaves, all of them, with Benjamin. They even said, before they searched the bags, they said, what? Because they were being accused. As soon as they left the city the second time, and Benjamin was with them and everything, so Joseph sent his son, overtake them, and then accuse them. What have you repaid me evil for good? Why is this? You stole my drinking cup. So they were alarmed. We wouldn't do that. We even returned the money the first time when we came back the second time. So why would we even take any gold or silver from the house? So they said, they were so sure that nobody stole it because they were honest people. So they said, no, whoever you find the goblet, he's worthy of death, and all the rest of us will even be slaves. So again, Joseph was lenient. He says, no, whoever found the goblet, we're not going to kill him, he'll be a slave, and the rest of you are free to go home. He set them up in order to now put them in the exact situation. Would they now abandon Benjamin like they previously did with Joseph? And Joseph had the rights to do this, Rabbi Chaim explained, because that was the two dreams. He had a dream of the wheat bowing down to his sheaf, and the heavenly spheres, which represent the higher levels of life, meaning perfection. So now, when the brothers first came down, and he saw them, and he recognized them, but they didn't recognize him, it says, V'yizkor Yosef es chalom osav. He remembered his dreams. Why does the Torah have to tell us at that point that he remembered his dreams? It sounds on the surface like an egotistical thing. Oh, look, my dreams finally came true, where they were bowing down to me when I was 17, and now I'm 30, the dreams came true. So a person who's not sensitive to the perfection of a Joseph is going to say that. But that's not what happened. What it says that he remembered the dreams, he now realized the license of the dreams. Those dreams were really for a reason. They were to train him in dream interpretation. There was to be a catalyst for him to come down to Egypt, ultimately to save the Jews and then take them out, and then they would end up at Mount Sinai and get the Torah. That was the optimum goal. But the dreams had a third function, and that was that they were a license, meaning there were two dreams. Meaning God was telling Joseph in the first dream that when they bowed down to you for wheat, then they will also bow down to your intelligence too. Meaning God was saying, at the moment that you see that their sheaves are bowed down to you, which means when you are superior to them in terms of sustenance, and that's going to be, Joseph now realized now is that point, when he was running Egypt with the famine. So he now understood the dreams to be related to each other. One dream complemented the other. At the time, so God was telling him, the first dream means this is a certain point that they're going to be subservient to your wheat, meaning they're going to be subservient to you in terms of sustenance. At that point, you now have permission to make them subservient to you in the higher spheres, meaning with the stars and the sun and moon, means that you now have permission to perfect them in terms of the spiritual. Okay? So that's what the two dreams were. The two dreams were really teaching Joseph that you're now getting a license from God to perfect them. Because normally, you cannot do this to a person. You can't put a person in a situation to force them to do repentance. No, that's a subjective thing. Each person, it's up to them to do their own, repentance. You can advise a person about a mistake that they're making, but you can't force them into a situation unless God gives you the license. And that's what the two dreams were. When they bow down to you for the wheat, then they're going to be subservient to, it'll be like the bowing down to you in terms of the heavenly spheres, meaning that's to represent the spiritual elevation that Joseph was now given license over his brothers. That's why he now forced him into a situation where he duplicated the same scenario, the same event. Just like they sold me, now let's see if they'll abandon that evil trait and stand up for Benjamin. So I'm going to frame Benjamin. I'll put him in a situation where he's now a danger to them. Let's see, and I'm giving them the ability to go home in peace and leave Benjamin here. Will they do that, or will they stick up for him and do complete repentance? Because like Maimonides says, real complete repentance is when you're in the exact situation, but this time you don't sin. So he really wanted the best for his brothers. That's why he did that. And this is all I'm just quoting verbatim what Rabbi Chaim mentioned. Okay, so you see that his concern was always for perfection. He never got absorbed in terms of the success that he had. And even tells the brothers when they came down that don't feel bad that you sold me, because I don't live. And again, this is Rabbi Chait's explanation. I don't live in the world of the relative where, you know, tit for tat, that you did this to me and I have to now take revenge. That's not how I live, Joseph said to the brothers. They were afraid now that he was in power that he would be vengeful for the sale some 20 years back. But he said, no, I'm here, God sent me, and the objective over here is to sustain you and my father and Egypt and the whole land. That's really how I look at things. I look at it from an objective standpoint. I'm not involved in the world of the personal where I care what somebody said about me or that I'm going to take revenge. I don't do those things. That's not how I function. That's what he told them. No, I'm God sent me here. So it doesn't matter. Yes, you did it. But the real objective good is what I look at. That's what Joseph said to his brothers. So you see, even then, he still never got absorbed. He never got caught up by the success. So, you know, going back to our verses, it fits in beautifully that the Torah is now telling you the level of perfection of this Joseph. That amidst his great rise to power and within those very 7 years of plenty, at the peak of the success, he still had the concerns about his father's household. But then it finally shifted because he had children. So he thanked God for having some release psychologically of being concerned about the whole pains that he had. He carried it around. It was a heavy yoke on his shoulders all these years. But there finally was some release. And what was that release generated from? From his own children. And now he was able to focus on that. So that new family life, right, there's only a certain amount of energy a person has that goes into any given area. So in terms of the area of family, now there was some release. And he praised God for that God helped me to forget that. And there was finally some release. And you see, very interestingly, what is he name? What's the subject of the name of the first child? That's in terms of the perfection and his concern about people. Meaning he forgot the toil, the pains of his own family life, and now he is starting his own family. The second son that he had talked about success. So you see, even the order of the names of his sons, what came first was human perfection. That's really what I'm naming the first son after. The second name would have to do with his own physical success. So you see, he didn't look at physical success as being prior. That came secondary. And even that was not an ends in itself, because you see at the end of that verse in 52, he says that God has made me successful, but it was in the land of my affliction. The success was really to remove him from the pain. It wasn't an ends in itself. So you see, even in that verse, if you look at the words, when he talks about naming his second son, because God has made me successful, but the success was really removal of the land of his affliction. You see that? So, really, the words themselves bear out, now we see clearly why these verses are inserted here. It teaches you a lesson. Now it works perfectly. It is an interruption. We're not saying that it's not an interruption, but the interruption is to say, all along, while he was successful, what was going inside Joseph's mind? It was perfection, people. That was really his focus. Okay, so let me just stop here and see if there's any comments or questions.
I was wondering if, Joseph knew the meaning of the dreams at the time he had them. It would not make sense for him to tell it, would it?
Which dreams?
The dreams of the sun and the moon that he had. It would make sense to tell it to his brothers, I would think.
But he did tell them. Evidently, he thought there was something here. He sensed, and maybe it was catering to his ego a little bit too much. And the brothers actually assessed him that way. He says, what, you, Hamishal, Timshal Bun, are you going to rule over us? They looked at that as being a real egotistical expression. And they thought it was dangerous. And that's why, according to one of the Rishonim, they could sworn on that they were justified in what they were doing. They thought that he was going to bring down the whole establishment of the Jewish people. He was dangerous. So they had to get rid of him. It wasn't an evil thing. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think Rabbi Mann actually mentioned that when they sat down, it was like convening as a jury against Joseph. So it showed that they were in full control of their thoughts, and it wasn't like an emotional response, but they thought it out, and they said, no, this is he's a danger to the establishment of the Israelites. So they sold him. But when he told all the dreams, that it was indicative of a dangerous, egotistical streak, and this is how the brothers assessed him.
Did he know at the time he had the dreams that they meant that he was going to be responsible for their perfection?
I don't think so, because you see that he first remembers the dreams now when they're standing in front of him.
Yeah, but that makes it much clearer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right, make sense?
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
Interesting. See, it shows you how the Torah works. It's not just a book you can read through. You've got to study. You've got to look for the clues. And they're there. Like Josh said Thursday, that the answer, the response, is by the side of the question, right in the verses. It's right there. Just let the words talk to you. I mean, it's the greatest lesson. That this is really, you can develop such great skills in terms of understanding how the Torah is written when you see instances like this. Okay. So there's a lot there. All right. Did we ever discuss Paro's naming of Joseph and then giving him, why he gave him the daughter of Potiphar as a wife?
I think we did in terms of getting him out of the situation of people, an accused former prisoner.
Right.
In other words, by giving him the daughter of the woman who accused him of rape, that would clear his name.
Exactly, right. That showed you Paro's. So again, right, that's an example like in one verse that this tremendous wisdom, because there's different ways, there's many ways the Torah gives you information. Another rule is that, as Rabbi Chait mentioned, that we have a tradition that anything that is mentioned in a single verse, doesn't matter how many ideas are there, they all have to be related. So that's another important lesson. Like why he changed his name to an Egyptian name, he wanted to, because he was trying to compensate for the reputation that he had as being accused of rape. So, and as a Hebrew, so now he changed him to like an Egyptian veneer, and he tried to clear up. But if he's marrying the daughter of the woman that accused him of rape, could that accusation really be true? Of course not. So he whitewashed the whole thing, and to shut up Potiphar himself. You see, all of a sudden in that verse also it says that. It's verse 45. It's right here. It's 41:45. Just for review, it's a really just amazing verse. It says that after Paro made him, a viceroy, so Paro called the name of Joseph the seer of secrets, and he gave him Asnas, who was the daughter of Potiphar, and now all of a sudden it says he's the priest of On. He wasn't a priest of On before this. But the verse ends, and it says that Joseph went out in Egypt. So this whole verse has to all be circling around one concept, and that concept is that Paro's wisdom in trying to whitewash everything, so this way Joseph would be an accepted leader. So changing his name is to give him to obscure the Hebrew identity that was accused, and to give him a name as being a respectable name. He's a seer of secrets. He's a wise individual. Who's like this? Let them focus now on the good, not on the bad. And then he wanted to quiet the mother, so he gives the daughter. This way she's not going to accuse Joseph anymore, because that'll just come back. And it'll stain her, because he's married to her daughter. So she'll stop the accusation. And just to stop Potiphar himself from anything, he gives him a priesthood. He gives him money. He gives him fame. But despite all those attempts, it says at the end of the verse, it wasn't Satnas Panech, it wasn't the Egyptian name that Paro just gave Joseph. Who goes out onto Egypt now? It says Joseph goes out onto Egypt. Meaning, despite Paro's attempts to change over, to do an entire makeover, Joseph retained his identity, which complements what we said today, just now, that he never lost focus. He was still the Joseph. He was still that Hebrew identity. Okay, and Yoshiyahu has a question online. Let me just take a look. He says, perhaps the new name that Paro gave him served to conceal his identity during his encounter with his brothers, part of Hashem's divine plan. I wouldn't agree, Yoshio. I would say that was Paro's own attempt to make to secure the success of his newly appointed viceroy. Paro didn't have any idea about the future. So he had no idea about his brothers even at that point. I don't even know if Joseph told him at that point that he had brothers. let alone that it'd be part of a scheme to help out the brothers. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So I noticed that Rashi on verse 50, on the words, when the year of famine had not set in, he's talking about having the two sons.
Right.
Rashi says, from here we see that it is forbidden for a person to have marital relations during years of famine.
Right.
That.
What's the question?
Seems rather extreme.
Yeah, I think even by the case of Noah, that he didn't cohabitate, you know, there was no intercourse the whole time he was on the ark. Meaning when there's you know, destruction in the world, so that's something which evidently causes a certain amount of restriction on the person. I'd have to think into it more, but just in general, the tone seems to imply that whenever there's this, there's great negativity and great loss. So it even says that Joseph didn't drink wine all the years he was in Egypt, until the time that his brothers came down with Benjamin and they sat down. And Rashi says now he finally drank. It says v'yishkru, that they drank. And you take a look at Rashi on that, that he didn't drink all that time. So his character was such a fine character that he wouldn't indulge in enjoyments and pleasures when there was a tragedy or devastation going on. That's just not the right attitude for a person.
Yes, but there's a counterexample, it seems, that when, before Moses was born, when his parents were together, they separated because they didn't want to have children because the males were being killed. And God came along and said, no, that's not your place to make that decision. It seems like that principle would apply in a time of famine as well.
Well, maybe that regular, that's true, but I don't think it was God there. I think it was actually Miriam who said that to her father. That, you know, Paro is only decreeing death on the males, but by you, you know, divorcing your wife, meaning my mother, so now you're not going to have males or females.
Oh, okay.
So, but there was an attitude over there. But there, it was purely to save. That they didn't want to have children that would have, you know, if he had a son, he would just, they would have a child just to be killed. That's a separate situation. But God did the opposite there. He actually made them multiply tremendously while they were in Egypt. But evidently, that situation is not the same as Joseph's, where he was sold and he felt, evidently there was some more of a need, I guess, in Joseph's case, that he felt that when the famine comes, not slavery, right? You see that it wasn't while he was, you know, still trapped in Egypt, and I don't know what his situation was once he became viceroy. He was still under the, you know, power's control, of course. But it was only because of the famine. That's what the verse is trying to say, that he had children before the years of the famine. You learn out from that that he didn't, you know, have intercourse after the famine started. That's what they're trying to learn out from there. But while in servitude, doesn't seem to be a problem. Famine seems to be a real, that's where people's lives are at stake, perhaps. So when that's happening, maybe that's the issue, actually, with Noah, too. That life was being destroyed in Noah's time, and a famine causes death. So those two cases, so to have children, maybe it's not an issue of pleasure, maybe it's an issue of that it would be wrong, philosophically, to create life when life is now perishing. So when life is perishing, either due to famine or due to the flood, having children is the wrong thing. And it's the correct attitude. But servitude is not something which causes death, so therefore there's no prohibition to have intercourse during that time. So perhaps that's a better answer. It's only when there are situations that life is perishing that you should not be involved in creating life. But in the situation of servitude, life is not perishing. Makes sense.
Well, unless I argue that at times when life is perishing, that's when you do need to be having children so that, you know, the whole race doesn't die out.
Well, no, because then you're just creating children that are going to die. It's meaningless. That's why even when Noah came off the ark, he was hesitant to get back together with his wife. And God says, no, get back together, because he was afraid there would be another flood and they'd be killed. So God promised that he would not bring another flood again. So that's the third instance that seems to back up this theory. The one is an issue of life, and that's at risk, so then the righteous person will not be involved in creating life. It's futile. All right, any other questions or comments?
Rabbi, I'm looking for something in the text that might give us more insight to the sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, because it sounds like they become very exceptional, and here they're raised and surrounded by Egypt and the influences of that, and even having a mother that's an Egyptian woman. And it seems like Joseph was very busy during that time preparing and with all of the affairs and stuff. Yet, you know, the blessing that Jews often give is, may your sons be like Ephraim and Manasseh. And so it just sounds like they became exceptional sons in following more their father's lead than the influence of Egypt.
Yeah, I'm sure that Joseph had an influence on his wife, too. So, but you know, for sure, he was very much concerned about that his children should be brought up with a correct philosophy. So they had to be, they had to take on their impression of their parents, or specifically Joseph, more than their society that they lived in. So it is a good point that despite the predominance of the Egyptian culture, they were fit to get the blessings of Jacob when he came down, and he made them into the equal status as the tribes. And Yoshiyahu, you're writing, can you please explain the verse, a man in whom the Spirit of God is? Right, so when Paro said to Joseph, or actually he was addressing all of his astrologers, when he heard Joseph's interpretation and his solution to the famine, and he showed Paro how he could make the famine into great success by having the plenty first, so he saw the wisdom, and evidently Egypt had. Rabbi Shade explained that they did not deny that there was one God, but the way they felt to relate to this one God is through all these sub-deities. So that is perhaps answers your question, how Paro can say the words about Joseph, when he was praising Joseph to all of his subjects and his viceroys, and he says to them, "Hanimtzu kazeh, yish asher ruach l'kimbo, that can there be found anybody like this Joseph, a man who the Spirit of God is?" Meaning they recognize that there is a creator, but that's not how they related to him. They related to him in an idolatrous fashion by saying that there's sub-deities through which we have to relate to God. That was the Jews also by the golden calf. They didn't say the golden calf was God. Ramban, Nachmanides says that. He says, no fool would say that the gold that they had in their ears and they plucked out and they melted it all together into a calf, that this gold that was in our ears is now responsible for taking us out of Egypt. So Ramban says, no fool would say that. They were just saying, this is now how we have to relate to God. And it makes a lot of sense because that explanation, because you see that when they miscounted the day of Moses' descent from Mount Sinai, they started counting too early. So they came to day 40 much too early. And they said, Moses is gone. But they said, Moses the man is gone. Why do you have to say Moses the man? Of course he's a man. But you understand that was put into the Torah to tell you their flaw. The flaw was that the Jews were over attached to the physical nature of Moshe, meaning they were very insecure without some sort of a physical figurehead. That's why they had to create the golden calf. They needed something physical to relate to. And Sforno says, because of the sin of the golden calf, God created the temple. The temple is a response. meaning God saw that the Jews had, it was impossible for them to relate to God directly. They needed some physical expression. Therefore, God allowed, as a concession, he created the temple. But it was highly regulated in laws to really keep the emotions, the religious emotion, in check. So you see that when the Jews said, Moses the man is gone, Moses the man. That means to say that they were overattached to physical leadership. And that's why they sinned and they made a golden calf. So God says they'll have to correct that and give them a correct way for the physical expression. I'll allow the physical expression in the religious sphere, but it will be on my terms. Okay, and Yoshiyahu is asking, so it was Paro's pagan way of seeing things. Well, it was the Egyptian culture, Yoshiyahu. I mean, that was the culture, and you see, it's human. It's a humanistic thing that people are very attached to the physical, and it's hard for people to really abstract themselves and relate to God, the God that we cannot see and we cannot know what he is, and relate on an intellectual level. So that's it's a difficult thing, but that's really what is possible, and that's really what God's goal is, to raise us to that point. Will we abandon the need for any type of physical leaders? I mean, it's, you know, it all comes from childhood. The child is extremely attached to the parent, and what happens is a child at a certain point should mature and realize when he gets older or she gets older that, you know, this view that they had of the parent as being like a super powerful thing that takes care of me and lifts me up and does all this, really, they're no different than me. That should really be the mature path that a person switches into once he gets old enough to see it. But some people are so crippled psychologically that they can't abandon the need. What? They can't abandon the need for the physical parent, so they project it onto reality, and then they pray to Jesus, or they you know, they have things like with the Rebbe's. They say the Rebbe's, even though they're dead, they're coming back, and they look at the Rebbe's as being like flawless, or they make idols, or they have amulets, all these different things. The idolatrous expressions really have their roots. You can trace it back to the infantile state, where the infant is terrified when those physical parents aren't around. So you know, Egypt had that, the Jews had that. I mean, we're all one duplicate design. There's no different types of human beings. So we should not be surprised when we see identical, you know, corruptions in all walks of life. Okay, my pleasure, Yoshiyahu, and Rivka, my pleasure. All right, any other questions or comments at this point? That was pretty much what I wanted to present for today. If you have side questions too, we can take them now. We have a little more time.
I think we're good.
Okay. All right, so maybe perhaps again, like last week, you know, again, we have another day off this week on Thursday, so I'll keep it notified. Perhaps we'll do another class Thursday, because again, everybody's going to be off, so it's a good time to, you know, spend some time. And 1 o'clock New York time worked for everybody last week?
It did last week. I'm not sure that it will work this week.
All right, so we'll see. I'm not sure if I'll do it yet. I'm just mentioning in passing. We'll see.
Okay.
All right. So yeah, I'll communicate by email if I do decide to do a class. If not, we'll just pick up on Sunday.
Okay. Thanks very much, Rabbi.
Okay, everybody.
You have a great week.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a good week to everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.